For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time once again for This Week in Oklahoma Politics with ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel and Republican political consultant Neva Hill. Well, lawmakers went down to the wire but managed to get everything done before the constitutional deadline last Friday. So let's give the 2017 legislature a letter grade. Neva, let's start with you. How do you think they did?
I would give them a C, and here's why. I think you start with the idea that at the beginning of the session, they dealt with the Real ID bill very quickly, bipartisan. It was significant. There were a lot of Oklahomans concerned, not only from the travel aspect, but frankly, people in commerce that were concerned about being able to still do business on the bases. And so it was something that was taken care of, and I think that was a plus. I think when you look at the budget hole and the long give and take through the session, the fact that they were able to hold as many agencies harmless to keep the core agencies from not taking huge cuts was significant. I think when you look at the fact that that they were able to avoid the special session, I think keeps them in the C category for me. If they'd gone to special session, obviously, I think that would have probably moved my C on down to a D. But all in all, I think very difficult year, but they were able to get through it. And I think that right now, when you take all of it in perspective, and kind of now that the dust has settled, there are some bright spots in all of the mess.
Ryan,
you know, they better be glad that they don't have end of instruction exams for the legislature because they would have failed every one of them. Neva, I think, you know, they avoided the special session for now, but it's likely that there's going to be another one. And I think that looking at the gimmicks that they pulled in that last week, you know, taking things like the cigarette tax and the car sales tax that they had been talking about as revenue raising measures for the entire session, and then just with a sleight of hand saying, well, they're not revenue raising measures because we say that they're not revenue raising measures and therefore they're constitutional. by doing that, I think that they've all but guaranteed that the Supreme Court is going to send them back in special session. This session did start with a lot of promise. You know, had the governor with the governor's criminal justice task force, which we'll talk about in a moment. We had a lot of momentum behind, you know, that issue in particular. We had a lot of momentum around building some investments and revenue raising measures from the governor's state of the state to the Democratic Party in the House, putting together their package. But where we're at right now is really, I mean, we're at least $400 million short in terms of the budget hole. We got nowhere near close to closing it. State services are going to be cut in a very damaging way to the people of Oklahoma. And so I've got to give them, I'm going to give them a D minus. And I'm not going to give them an F, because we've talked about this some this session, where admitting that you've got a problem is the first step towards recovery. We've begun to see, I think, a corner turned in terms of understanding that cutting taxes does not necessarily raise revenue the way that it's been promised by the Republican majorities for years.
And the governor has signed the $6.8 billion budget. It's official, holds 16 state agencies harmless and cuts others 4 to 5%. So what do we think about this budget once it's finally, you'd already mentioned, Neva, that it does hold some harmless. Of course, holding places harmless doesn't necessarily mean there's not going to be cuts themselves.
Well, I mean, but what it does say is when you had a billion-dollar shortfall, when you had this hole that was so deep, the fact that they were able to get where they are right now, I mean, I think agencies have to look at it and step back and say, we could be in a very, a much worse situation. I mean, they were talking about scenarios, 5, 10, and 15% cuts to their agencies. What would that have been? Now, that would have been catastrophic cuts if you start talking 15%. To core agencies in particular. So, you know, it's all relative. But the bottom line is we have a long way to dig out of the hole. But I think there are at least some signs on the horizon that the economy is improving. We're not going to change it next session, but at least we can continue to move hopefully in the right direction.
Ryan, what are your thoughts on this budget?
Well, you know, I think, again, it's a budget based on gimmicks. The appropriations chair in the House, Leslie Osborne, she said this is a gamble. She said, you know, it's up to the Supreme Court to say whether something's constitutional or not. Well, sure, that's right. I'm glad that you recognize that at this moment. I hope you recognize it later in the future as well, whenever they make decisions you don't like. But now it's up to the legislature, though. They've given you guidance, and they've said in past cases that measures that increase the tax burden are revenue-raising measures. They know this, and they know it full well. And they put together these gimmicks. She said, I've gambled by passing pro-life bills that I knew were unconstitutional, hoping that the Supreme Court would uphold them, and they haven't. I'm gambling now by putting this in front of the Supreme Court as well. The cuts that some of these agencies are looking at are effectively those 15 or 20% cuts, because as you said, Michael, in a year where if you, even if you're standstill, you're standstill in a status quo that is unacceptable. So a lot of these agencies have been cut to the bone in previous years. So even a standstill is just the continuation of those previous cuts.
A couple of Governor Fallon's corrections reform bills fell short of the deadline. The bills sought to reduce prison times and give more options to send nonviolent offenders to programs. The bills never got a hearing in conference committee, so they can still come back next year. Ryan, your thoughts on the failure of these bills to pass?
I think that it's one of the most disappointing things about this legislative session. We talk about the budget, and these criminal justice reform bills, you know, substantively, when we think about the criminal justice reform system, you know, that's one thing. But from a fiscal standpoint, from a budgetary standpoint, it's difficult to look at any budget that the governor was going to sign and just did sign and say that it's a responsible budget without incorporating these sentencing reform measures. Because what that does is that it just guarantees that that 10-year growth in prison population that we're projecting is going to continue. And it's just unsustainable, and it's dangerous for the people of Oklahoma. What's happened this session was that the Speaker of the House, Speaker Charles McCall, in one of the weakest moves of a speaker I've ever seen, empowered a single committee chair, Representative Scott Biggs, to hold the entire bipartisan reform package hostage in his committee and allowed him to play these games that I think that if the people of Oklahoma saw them, they'd show up with pitchforks at the Capitol, because he would literally call a committee meeting into order and then filibuster, you know, speak and talk and talk and talk, and then close the committee meeting out before anybody ever had a chance to advance votes or to debate or question. To give this one member that power to kill these bills, I think was a terrible move by the speaker. And I think that it doesn't fully represent the bipartisan movement behind criminal justice reform in the state of Oklahoma.
And even this is had both sides were in support of this. Former Speaker Chris Steele was trying to push this through in the last days.
Absolutely. And this is one area where Ryan and I are in complete agreement, right, that criminal justice reform is something that the people of Oklahoma have clearly and loudly spoken about. And I think that the legislature is now slowly coming into this mix. And unfortunately, Ryan is right. I mean, we had a situation where in an attempt to try to either move from committees or wire around these so that this process could go forward, even in the closing hours of the session, it didn't happen. And I think it's deeply disappointing to folks who had not only high expectations, but really are absolutely dead set on seeing it happen. So progress was slow this year. I think we come back next year, these things will be back on the table. Mm-hmm. And frankly, it may have a different dynamic next year when you really think about the fact that not only will all of these House members be up for re-election, but you'll have all district attorneys in the state of Oklahoma up for re-election. And that's been a strong force overall against much of this criminal justice reform package as it's unfolded. So I think that, you know, I think that this is something that's not going to go away. And I think that legislators are going to have to get up to speed. Many of those freshmen who were not well-versed on mm-hmm. the ins and outs, I think will do their homework between now and the next session. And hopefully we'll see some quick action early in the session rather than have it drag all the way through.
Now, while it will be back next year, it did have momentum. You had the 780, 781 mm-hmm. passed last November. So really sent a message to lawmakers, hey, we want corrections reform. And the governor had called for it in her State of the State. And there is a vote, Nick. There, people are running for re-election next year. So they don't want to be seen as weak on crime. Is there concern that
it's an education process? I think when we continue to have a clear message out there to educate the public, they are beginning to understand much more quickly than I think we give them credit for a whole lot about this whole need to really have these major reforms. And we know, based on what we see every day and hear about with the Department of Corrections, we are long overdue. And Ryan is right. We can cannot sustain where we are today. And I think these smart reforms have to move forward and hopefully in rapid speed next session.
I'm glad Neva mentioned the district attorneys and their elections next year, because when we think about opposition to criminal justice reform measures, you know, a lot of times whenever we talk to our allies at the ACLU, they'll say, oh, well, it's the private prison industry. They're the ones that are opposing this stuff. Hey, listen, I think that the private prison industry is despicable. I think it's one step away from human trafficking. It's legalized human trafficking. But they're not the folks out at the Capitol lobbying against this. The chief impediment to criminal justice reform in the state of Oklahoma are prosecutors and the District Attorney's Council, which is the state-funded, the taxpayer-funded organization of district attorneys in the state of Oklahoma. They are the chief impediment. Prosecutors are standing in the breach, preventing these reforms from taking place. They empowered Scott Biggs. They put enough fear into the speaker to keep Scott Biggs in control of the reform measures this session.
The speaker could have put it in another.
He could have put it in another committee. The speaker could have killed the repeal effort, the rollback effort of State Question 780, authored by Scott Biggs, and in the Senate we had Ralph Shorty authoring one of those prior to his departure from the Senate. And so those things could have been killed by leadership. In the Senate we saw that demise there, and then in the House the speaker could have said, "We're not going to hear House Bill 1482," but he did anyways. And so to allow that to have momentum, but then to allow the reforms to be killed, I think is a direct reflection of the prosecutors and their influence at the Capitol. It's outsized, it's disproportionate, and voters, if you want to do anything between now and next session to move criminal justice reform, call your prosecutor up. Let them know that they're accountable to the electorate like everybody else.
Supporters of measures to reform Oklahoma liquor laws were probably the biggest winners this past session. Several new laws follow up on the passage last November of State Question 792, allowing strong beer and wine in grocery stores. The bills expand the hours of operation for liquor stores and craft breweries, allow for the vote on Sunday alcohol sales and others. Nevo, your thoughts on this, on these slew of bills that kind of went through?
Well, and I think it's a continuation again of the sentiment out there that clearly was projected with State Question 792, that this was where Oklahomans wanted to see the reform and the modernization take place. So I think, and I think some of that is akin to what we're talking about on the correction side. You educate and change the narrative, and that's what the proponents of these measures did very successfully. They were able to take away stereotypical, notions and ideas and move into a different framework to be very successful in what they've done. And I think that may be something to point back to with the folks on the criminal justice side looking at trying to help these folks that think they can't be tough on crime, that the narrative has to be what has been started and I think has to continue forcefully, that it's about being smart on crime. So, I think this is fascinating when you really look and see that when you have a very broad, well-crafted plan and you execute it, you can be successful on measures like we're seeing in this area.
Yeah, there was a lot of these things were put in, all was supposed to be in 792, but Senator Bice said, no, wait, we can't do all of this at once. Let's pull back. And usually when you do that, that means they don't always get passed, and yet they worked really
and
hard.
And I think
to
she was very wise on the local control component of saying that let the county commissioners decide and set these elections on some of the issues that they could have put in that state question and chose not to.
So people vote.
And obviously we're very successful in getting it through the legislature.
And I think we'll see more bills like this. Neva talked about breaking this idea of stereotypes and notions about what alcohol use is. And we've reached kind of peak in terms of marketing and education about what alcohol is, and the idea that it's this seedy underbelly, and contrast that with Coupel Works and some of the other folks around Oklahoma that have these wonderful tasting areas, and they're bringing in people from around the country to taste products, to visit Oklahoma, to look at what some of our brewers in the state of Oklahoma are able to accomplish right here. That's really breaking this mold, and I think that it speaks to this idea of breaking the prohibition era rhetoric about alcohol that is, is really this abstinence message that it just hasn't worked. And I think that we see the same thing, now that we think about like what craft breweries look like. Mm-hmm. We're going to look like that if you go to Colorado right now in the marijuana industry. We talk about prohibition, modern prohibition with marijuana as well. It's the same thing. It's built on, you know, broken stereotypes and false assumptions about what marijuana is and what marijuana users look like and act like.
Going back and to Reefer Madness.
Going back to Reefer Madness. It's, you know, it's this huge lie that's lasted for nearly a century now. And we're beginning to see that chipped away at. And you know, we've seen it with alcohol. And now that we've hit this peak now where I think we're going to see more and more modernization laws, I think that eventually we'll probably see that with drug reform as well. Not we've seen it in other states. We'll probably see it in Oklahoma.
Well, when you start to show that alcohol is a business, that Oklahoma makes money off of it, and not because of people getting drunk or driving drunk or whatever, it really shows that's when you start to get the business and the chambers interested, and they want a part of this as well.
Absolutely. And I think when you look at these issues, people make their own personal determinations on that issue. But when you look at it from a public policy or a legislative standpoint, what I think all Oklahomans want to see is responsible, thoughtful legislation that moves through the process. And if it comes to a ballot and they get to make their voice heard specifically on those issues on a ballot, so be it. It's clear in Oklahoma that we have a changing demographics. And I think with that come a lot of these issues moving to the forefront that are being addressed legislatively as well as in state questions.
Oklahoma City Mayor Mick Cornett announced via Twitter he plans to run for governor. He would likely be running as a Republican against Lieutenant Governor Todd Lamb, Tulsa lawyer Gary Richardson, State Auditor and Inspector Gary Jones in a primary. Ryan, do you think this changes the GOP race with Mick Cornett saying he wants to be a part of it?
Oh, this is tectonic plate shifting. Wow. in real time right now. This mm-hmm. this is huge. I think that if Mick Cornett walks into that Republican primary, I think that he's an immediate front runner. You know, Todd Lamb, you know, many people have, you know, considered him this heir apparent to the Republican nominee. And I don't think that that's ever been the case, but it's certainly not the case today with Mick Cornett in the race. If Mick Cornett is in that Republican primary, he turns that thing on its head. And I think that the challenge for everyone else is going to be to get in a runoff with Mick Cornett. He brings a solid constituency from Oklahoma City where he has enormous favorable ratings, even among some progressives and Democrats. And that's going to be a huge impact for him you know, in the general. But I think if he made it to the general, but I think even in the primary, you know, he walks in with these Oklahoma City voters. The real challenge for Mick Cornett is going to be, and this is if he's in this Republican primary. I think if he runs as an independent, you know, this is a different mm-hmm. scenario. But in the Republican primary, here is a Republican whose entire legacy, which I think, you know, many would say is a successful legacy, is based on moderation on social issues and raising taxes. And that's, you know, not necessarily the winning message for a Republican primary. If he has to tack so far right on social issues, I think that that would doom him in a general election, because a lot of the folks that want to see Mick Cornett in the governor's office want to see him there because he's the guy that, as mayor, has been receptive to minorities and diversity and protecting minorities' interest, everybody from the LGBT community to the Muslim community. And, you know, that's not really the message that gets you out of a Republican primary.
Neva.
I think it will be a fascinating Republican primary. And here's why. It has all of the makings. I mean, you're right. When you take the geography in a Republican primary, if you have a dominant Oklahoma City 5th District candidate, Mick Cornett, Todd Lamb coming out of that area. Then you have in Tulsa, you have Gary Richardson with, you know, coming out of the 1st District area. There is a lot of conversation in that area that I pick up around Tulsa that there is a millionaire self-funder potentially looking at getting in the race, business person who clearly would kind of, again, add another slice and piece to the equation. And then you have Gary Jones, who's out running, and he is someone who his base, I think you would naturally say, is the rural Republican voters that know him best and that he's been most effective in energizing, not only as in his time as state chair, but during his years that he's been in statewide office. So you have a situation where no one can dominate. It is the two-prong factor of not only do you have to run a good primary, but you have to make sure you get in that runoff. And mm-hmm. so I think spending will be a lot of it. I think certainly Mick Cornett getting in the race changes the dynamic on fundraising probably for Todd Lamb, while he has $1 million in the bank mm-hmm. and has got the kind of the foothold starting place in fundraising. It doesn't, that could erode very quickly with a very aggressive fundraising effort on Mick Cornett's part. And let's also look at beyond his kind of all of the things he's done as mayor and having been involved now for 13 years kind of in on city politics, he's someone who has a national profile Republican Party-wise. He's someone that's been on the podium at national conventions.
RNCs,
been, you know, he is someone that's high profile in his position as heading up the Conference of Mayors. So he has a network out there that clearly will help him in terms of the fundraising component and how he can go beyond just the borders of Oklahoma. And that becomes very significant when you're talking about raising literally several millions of dollars to be able to be competitive.
Well, name recognition maybe possibly outweighs some of the things he's done as mayor, so they can't really bring up the policy so much as you've got basically a very famous person running for the job.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, if it outweighs some of that, I mean, you get into a runoff and the smaller number of people that are voting are going to be your more ideological primary runoff primary voters. And they're going to care about, you know, where is Mick Cornett going to stand on reproductive rights? They're going to care about where does he stand on LGBT issues. And they're, you know, and probably not care about them the same way I do, but they're going to make them relevant in that campaign, right? And they'll make them relevant in the campaign. Right. And, you know, going back to fundraising, I bet of the people that are on Todd Lamb's $1 million balance sheet right now, a lot of them, Mick Cornett is probably going to have a similar friendship or a relationship with. He's going to be calling them up and say, hey, I know you gave to Lieutenant Governor Lamb, but that was before I was in the race, and I need you to help me out. And they're going to match those a lot of those donations over to Mick because they're going to want to pick a winner, right?
Yeah.
And you know, some of them will say, "Listen, I've already picked my candidate. I'm going to be there." But you'll see a lot of people making similar, if not identical, contributions to Mick that they've already made to Todd Lamb.
And I think what is clear is summertime will be peak, you know, kind of peak startup season for these campaigns. No one's going to wait till the fall now. There are too many folks out there that are either seriously in or seriously entertaining the idea of being in. So it's game on for 2018 and the governor's race.
Governor Lamb said he was going to wait until the summer. Okay, so it's not going to be till next week when he makes it official. Is there a possibility that Mick Cornett is not going to be a Republican?
I think it's possible. If Mick Cornett runs as an independent, he could run as somebody who, I think that in many ways he has an easier path to the governor's mansion as an independent than he does if he is a Republican. I think it's harder for him to get out of the Republican primary and be the kind of general election candidate that guarantees you a spot in the governor's mansion. If you've got Scott Inman as the Democratic Party nominee, especially, you know, Scott's been very conservative on social issues, probably more conservative on social issues than Mick Cornett's been as mayor. So that could set up a real dynamic within Democratic voting and independent voting blocks. Who do they support? Do they support somebody in Mick that's maybe a little bit more progressive and liberal on social issues than the Democratic nominee himself? That would be a really interesting
campaign
situation.
And I guess that's a question, is where is he on those issues? I don't know that that's really kind of a known factor among many Republicans. So if he chose to be a pro-choice Republican running versus a pro-life Republican running, clearly in a primary, as I think we've said many times on the show here, that makes it very difficult to win a party nomination when the vast majority of Oklahoma Republicans do fashion themselves as conservative, pro-life, pro-Second Amendment. All of the traditional things we hear are at the core of who they are philosophically and politically speaking, what they look for in their candidates. So can the narrative change, and is it about other things, about leadership, about the future, about a vision that someone casts that catches hold and people start to say, okay, I don't like some of these things about this candidate, but maybe I'll look past those and still be willing to vote for that person. That will be an interesting dynamic in a Republican primary that we haven't seen very often in Oklahoma.
Certainly be very interesting. Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.